Hi, and welcome to the final episode of our inaugural season of The Situation of Education. This episode is entitled Divergent Learners. We all want what's best for our children. They come to us squalling and small, needing as much of our protection, nurturing, and guidance as it takes to raise them up into independent beings prepared for their own interactions with the world. When they're ready, we send them off to schools for each day for programming and formal mandatory education that will further help them develop as citizens. In Canada, many parents exercise the option to enroll their children in French immersion education in an effort to give them an even stronger start with training in both our country's official settler languages. That's where my own son's learning journey began. Ben was a very bright and energetic kid, and I thought he might benefit from the additional challenge of acquiring French language skills. But after a few years, it became apparent that the brightness that both I and his teachers perceived was mitigated by some other factors that were hampering his performance. After undergoing a standard evaluation offered by district psychology personnel, it was determined that Ben was indeed gifted. But he also labored with some exceptionalities in the area of difficulty with output. That dual diagnosis meant that Ben is what is considered a twice exceptional learner. He has not just one learning difference, but two. He could do the thinking, but struggled when it came time to produce the work to prove it. Ben stayed with French immersion for one more year until we finally decided that he may be best off in an English language school. Without getting into too much detail, suffice it to say that Ben made it through high school. Yay! And after a brief exploration of what the trades might be like, he's decided that he'd like to study archaeology and is in the process of upgrading in order to achieve that dream. But for both of us, some of that early confusion and angst around that long-ago assessment still exists. And I know that we're not alone in that. Like many families in the same situation, we were so busy trying to work around these circumstances that we didn't have a lot of time to look very deeply at how similar circumstances were playing out for others. In this episode, I speak with several people who have spent a good portion of their lives working with twice exceptional learners and the teachers who teach them. To begin, I speak with Dr. Serge Lacroix of UBC about some of the things he has learned over the years, including some discussion of what he wishes others understood about learning exceptionalities. Following that, I speak with Janet McCarran and then Jennifer Jack, both of whom have taught in the Vancouver School Board program designed to meet the needs of twice exceptional learners. Their perspectives on working with students with this diagnosis, as well as with their parents and the other teachers in the school, reveal just how deeply some of the difficulties these students face can go. And finally, we'll hear from Ben himself, who offers us a few words of wisdom for students, parents, and teachers just starting on this journey. So I'm here with Serge Lacroix of the University of British Columbia. Hi, Serge.
Hello.
Thanks for coming to talk to me today. I want to ask you a little bit about what drew you into your work with students with giftedness and learning disabilities.
I'd say the first thing that comes to mind is the fact that they are, by definition, exceptional students.
Right.
We're talking about students that are in the 98th percentile. They're doing better than the vast majority of the population, and them being learning disabled at the same time makes them even more exceptional. For sure, that is certainly something that is quite attractive in terms of dealing with the assessment portion, the intervention portion, knowing these students, also again the exceptional character of who they are, just because of these high abilities, certainly was a main attraction to me.
Right, and there must be some trying to alleviate the frustration that goes along with some of that 2E sort of diagnosis that must be play into your thinking around this as well.
That's a good way to spin it. The frustration, or at least wanting to share a certain understanding again of the exceptional character of their situation. Yes, like it's because it is hard to have that recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we'll kind of get into that, but just the fact that they are duly exceptional.
Right.
The fact that they are very high functioning, but on the other end, they're also struggling with some basic skills that are mastered by students that certainly don't have the same level of intelligence as they have.
Right.
So, yes, that, I'd say that's where the frustration lies.
Yeah, and I think it can be significant. So, are there any aspects of your own research or your own work with students who are assessed with gifted learning disabilities, or assessed as gifted learning disabled, I should say, that have surprised you as you've gone through the years?
I'd say what is most surprising is to see those two exceptionalities in action at once.
Mm-hmm.
To have someone who's very bright, that has like an incredible vocabulary, that is able to express himself or herself at a very high level, yet cannot read those simple words
right.
that are so much lower than their own, let's say, vocabulary. So to see that high level of skill in one area that is generally expressed in everyday life, and yet when they're doing something in class that is very simple, again, some basic decoding or some reading tasks that are probably 2, 3, 4, 5 grades below their actual level of functioning, and to see them struggle, that's something surprising. Like
mm-hmm.
that is hard to almost to accept.
Yeah.
Because it is, again, so unusual.
I think that presents a frustration for classroom teachers too.
Oh, I think that must be very hard. They need to be so flexible because they also have to deal with these differences, the discrepancy between them, like the students being so high functioning and struggling. The teachers have to deal with these students daily.
Mm-hmm.
They have to deal with these students when they're doing reading, when they're doing writing tasks, if it's math, when they're doing math, and later on in science and social studies and in all these subjects.
Right.
So yes, it must be quite challenging for teachers
Do you work at all with teachers, or is it largely with the students?
Both. Mm-hmm. I supervise students that work in the school system,
okay.
So we interact with teachers all the time. In all our assessment reports, we have recommendations for teachers. When we're going through the assessment process, there's always an interview with the teacher. There's always a report out to the teacher. So certainly we're actively engaged in what's happening in class. We do classroom observation. So we try to come up with suggestions on things that could be done for the classroom, for all of the students, and for the student that we're specifically testing.
Right.
So, yes.
Because that student it's not just their problem or burden.
No.
It really affects the entire learning environment, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Because, again, in their interaction, if they're working in a group, if they're doing something that will eventually involve the other ones in class, yes, they also have to deal with the fact that at times they're struggling, and at times they're high flyers. They're
mm-hmm.
they're so much above all the others in the classroom. So yes, they're not an island in the classroom. They're
no.
much, very much part of what's going on.
Right. What would you say, so based on all those experiences, what do you think teachers need to know about twice exceptional students?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is they have to know that it's happening at once. Those students are not exceptional one day in one area and then the next day it'll be something else. It can be throughout the day where they will show how skillful they are, and throughout the day they can also show how much they're struggling.
Mm-hmm.
So teachers have to be prepared for that, meaning they have to prepare their teaching, they have to prepare the materials, they have to prepare tasks for these students that will recognize that these two exceptionalities are occurring daily and pretty much at once. So I think that's the big one.
Mm-hmm. Have you had teachers that sort of rejected that diagnosis of their students, or that sort of struggled to implement
mm-hmm.
your suggestions and recommendations in their classes?
Yeah, I would not say actively rejecting it, but certainly having a hard time understanding it.
Right.
Making sense of that child, for example, that is orally so fluent, so at ease with language, and yet when they try to put something on paper, they will have something that is, like I mentioned, 3, 4, or 5 grades lower than what they just heard.
Right.
So while they're not rejecting that reality, they kind of have a hard time saying, oh, no, I think he's just playing, or he doesn't want to try, he's lazy. Like, they'll come up with descriptors like this, not recognizing that they're actually struggling for real.
So there's almost a cognitive dissonance.
There's, yes. But the dual exceptionality itself is a cognitive dissonance.
Right.
It's because you have someone who's so extreme one way and so extreme the other way.
Is there an average age where students are often presenting in this way, where a diagnosis may be requested?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very early on, it is certainly noticed by parents. Parents will have their child coming into kindergarten already saying, he's been reading for a year or two, he's been doing math, he does multiplication, he understands things way beyond his age. And rarely will they be tested in kindergarten. But by the time they're in grade 2, grade 3 at the latest, for sure something needs to happen. Some school system will have grade 3 as the year where they test everybody, they screen everybody. But they do it in grade 3 knowing that, I'd say, symptoms of giftedness were already there way before grade 3. Like they're present before they enter school.
That makes a lot of sense. And then sometimes the learning disabilities, though, are not necessarily evident until the testing takes place.
Yes, well, yeah, exactly, because either you focus on, let's say, the giftedness, or they've been focusing on the actual learning disability and not recognizing the giftedness.
What kind of learning conditions would you most like to see improved in schools that would benefit the populations of students that you study?
My kind of number one recommendation is what I call creative scheduling. These children do not have to be in class from 9 to 3, Monday to Friday. You have to be, like, teachers have to be flexible. Parents have to be flexible. You have to recognize, again, going back to exceptionality, you have to recognize that their exceptional functioning should translate into exceptional scheduling. So if they could have something other than the 9 to 3, Monday to Friday schedule, where they simply go through the curriculum, maybe at a faster pace, but it's still only the curriculum, that's not enough. They need to do more being not doing grade 6 material in grade 5, more mean doing something outside of the curriculum, outside of what's offered in the school system. And it could be all sorts of program of mentorship. It could be a different kind of schooling, a different kind of life experience. Again, all this within the schedule. All this would be admissible. All this maybe could account for credits in high school.
Right.
But that'd be kind of my number one change in terms of conditions, learning conditions.
It's interesting to me because my background in Indigenous education, that sounds a lot more like what I would like to see in schools as well, not just for the twice exceptional learners, but for all of the learners. Let's be a little more human about the way we present this and, you know, move away from the factory model that has informed where we've come to.
That's a good way to put it. The factory model, yes.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your time, Dr. Lacroix. It was very interesting to speak with you, and I'm sure that our listeners will have a lot of things to think about going forward. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So in my quest to find out a little bit more about how schools deal with twice exceptional learners, I spoke to a former colleague and friend, Janet McCarron. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. So I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, just based on some earlier conversations we've had on this topic. What drew you into your work with twice exceptional students?
Well, it was a winding path that I never would have anticipated. But when I first left teacher education, my first job was as a resource teacher, helping students who had a variety of special needs, none of whom were gifted. And I did that for 6 months, and I think it ended up having an impact on the rest of my career. I ultimately ended up teaching English and became the English department head, and I was teaching enriched English. And I had a particular student in my enriched English 9 class, and he was exceptional and highly gifted, and I felt like I wasn't meeting his needs in my class. And so I decided I wanted to learn more about what I could do for people like that, so straight gifted. And I did a lot of personal research. I did a lot of professional development for gifted and became involved with the Gifted Advisory Committee with the Vancouver School Board. And I learned a lot about it, and it was great. Then, meanwhile, in the Vancouver School Board, there is a program. It's called Gifted Learning Disabled Program. It started at Prince of Wales with a woman named Corrine Bees, who's awesome. And it was a really successful program. So they decided they wanted to open a second one on the east side of Vancouver. And I was somewhat recruited, asked if I would like to be the program teacher on the east side. And it's a great story because I thought, well, I don't know anything about this, so I want to learn more. And so I phoned the program teacher at PW, whose name is Chris Bromage. And he just happened not to be in the room when I phoned, but one of his students answered. And a student was very polite and said, oh, can I take a message? And I said, yes, my name is Jenna McCarran. I'm thinking about being the program teacher for Gold on the east side of Vancouver, and I just have some questions. And he said, oh, you have to do this. You have to do it. And I said, why? What do you mean? And he says, oh, it's just the best program, and it's just saved my life, and you just absolutely have to do it. It's amazing. And I kind of got off the phone, and I thought, I guess I have to do this. So I ended up going and visiting the program and learning more about it, and sure enough, I became the program teacher.
So were there common struggles that your students faced, or did each student sort of present a new case?
Well, of course, every individual student is completely different, but we have to think about the fact that in the case of the Gold program, students were referred, and they had all had psychological testing, which had been either recommended by a classroom teacher or maybe a counselor or perhaps a parent. And so in the end, the people who are identified are the ones who have some kind of struggle at school,
right,
where someone has decided that they are not, this particular student is not meeting his or her potential.
Right.
And the most likely reason for that is because they're not getting the grades that are expected at school. And I would say the most likely reason for that is because they are either struggling with their reading or their writing, which is the majority of the work that's evaluated. And so I would say that that tends to be the kind of student who ended up in the program and the ones that were identified. If someone's giftedness masks their disability, then they're not going to be identified.
Right.
And if somebody's disability masks their giftedness, that can also not be identified.
Right. So what struggles did you face with other faculty in trying to get accommodations for your students? So did you encounter those folks that had more rigid thinking, and then how do you help get them on side to support the students?
Yeah, it's interesting because some of the staff members that I had the biggest struggles with ironically had really strong ethics themselves and were actually highly principled people. And they always struggled with what was fair. And for them, what was fair, I guess, would divide into two categories: what's fair for the student and then what's fair for the other students in the class. So looking at the individual student, let's say that they are teaching English and there's a big high stakes exam at the end of the year worth 20% or 40% of their final grade. They're really worried if a student doesn't write an essay because it will impact that individual. They're also really worried that it's not fair to the other students. If it's a math class and you're saying, oh, this one can't memorize the times tables, no matter how long you ask them to study it, they will never, ever, ever be
that
able to
remember
them. So I think they should have a calculator. And they're saying, but that's not fair to the other students in the class who don't have the opportunity to have a calculator. And so it's that difference between what is fair and what is equitable. And it's really hard to get people to see that. And it's tragic because that same principled person would not expect that a student in a wheelchair would do long jump in PE class, even if it's part of the curriculum and part of the regular assessment, and yet somehow they don't believe that this difference in thinking warrants the same kind of accommodations.
What is it that you found that helped your students the most when you were working with the GOLD program?
Well, of course, it's going to be the case with all students, and that is caring relationships and people who really listen and seek to understand and to help. And what I found most helped the students was their own self-acceptance. Sometimes, and I did notice this growth between grade 8 and grade 12 for sure, and part of it is maturity, part of it is they have a better chance to choose the courses that they're taking in schools, and they can avoid the roadblocks that have been preventing them from reaching success. But just I remember a couple of times during classroom conversations I asked the students, if you had a choice, if you could say, you know what, I don't have a learning disability, or I don't have autism, or I don't have ADD, whatever it was that's the second thing that's right. attached to the giftedness. If you had a choice of getting rid of that, but it also meant that you would lose your giftedness, what would you choose? And they all said they would keep their giftedness.
Interesting.
Every single one of them. And so to me, that's nice. And then they can get that self-acceptance and like, I have this asynchronous way of learning and understanding, but it's unique to me and I can embrace it and it's fine. And what I need, you know, the ultimate goal and what's going to help them the most is if they can be really upfront with people about their needs with their teachers and advocate for themselves and say, well, you have this project in physics that requires that I write a lab report, but what if instead, and I have to tell you this is a true story, what if instead I adapt my mother's vacuum cleaner without her knowledge and make a catapult for ping pong balls and test it out in the class and almost hit the vice principal as he walks in the room? And you know what? Yeah, you can. You can do that. You can demonstrate the same knowledge that you would have had to in that written report.
Right. The final question I'll ask you is sort of the blue sky question. If you could alter the way we deliver schools and schooling to make it more available to twice exceptional students and to all students, really, what changes would you make?
Well, it is cliche, I guess, but it's true that what aids one student will aid all of them. And so I'm really glad that we are changing the curriculum and the types of assessments that the students are doing. I think ultimately what's going to help every individual student is differentiation in instruction, in the work that they produce, how it's assessed, and really look and see what does a individual student need to do in order to succeed and then focus on that. And it requires an openness of thinking and creative teaching. And I think that the new curriculum is going to allow classroom teachers to have that flexibility.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think when I think about the student teachers that I work with, you know, sometimes I think there's anxiety around that idea of differentiated learning and of multiple forms of assessment than, you know, and the notion that every student may need to prove their work differently means maybe in the most horrifying sense that that's 30 different ways of doing the same project if you're talking about a high school class. But really, that's not what we're talking about. You might, you know, give three or four options of completion for a particular assignment, and that will probably address most of the students. And then maybe you have one more that comes in and needs to, you know, advocate for their own way of doing it that's outside of those ways, but it's not that overwhelming.
It shouldn't be, and hopefully there is some kind of special needs teacher or resource teacher that can help the student scaffold so that they are producing work in a way that is manageable for the classroom teacher. And I think the majority of students are going to choose to do the essay still. But, you know, every now and then someone might decide to do a podcast, and that should be an option that's okay. And we just keep it manageable.
Right.
And I know that there's a big push now to have the students to self-assess, which obviously they need to learn how to do well. But with that training, I think that that will really help as well. Or maybe they produce five different things and they only submit one for assessment. There's so many different options here, and give teachers permission to do things a little bit differently.
Right. That's such an important part of this whole puzzle. I really appreciate the things that you've shared with us, Janet, and I think your perspective as a you know, boots on the ground classroom teacher in this regard has been really helpful. And thanks so much for coming to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So to get a little more information on what it's like to work with twice exceptional students, I decided to call on another colleague, Jennifer Jack. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Shannon.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
I've got a couple of questions for you. So what? First of all, I mean, let's start with the beginning. What drew you into education as a career?
Well, I was working at a local university in the admissions office, and I was doing clerical work. But I was interested in kind of moving a little bit up the ladder, but I didn't dress the same way, wear little suits and heels and nylons and those kind of things.
Right.
Basically, I was told, well, you don't wear the right shoes.
So, goodness.
And that's okay. Like, I'm used to being an outsider that way and feeling a bit different from typical.
Yeah.
So I wound up actually leaving a full-time clerical job and working temporarily at in the same place. But while I was doing that, I volunteered one day a week in a couple classrooms in a local high school.
Mm.
Because I had taken a look at my volunteer experience, and I'd done some volunteering at Mosaic with new Canadians working on just letter sound recognition, and I had taken an education course, and one of the pet projects of the prof was helping women on the Downtown East Side get their GEDs. So I volunteered there once a week for 8 or 9 months, and it was really eye-opening. It was very interesting, and so I started looking at that, and then I thought back to the fact that I used to do conversational English with a young Japanese woman who was here studying. And so I sort of started to see that there were all these things that were really falling into place. And my undergrad degree is in English and Women's Studies. And I think I resisted education as being a kind of your typical female job. And
I know that feeling well.
Yeah. But then looking back to when I was a kid, come end of July, what are we playing? We're playing school.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so there were enough things falling into place that I thought, well, you know, and it's hard to get into English at SFU, and you really have to have a solid set of experiences. So I worked at a local high school, and I was put with an amazing teacher who had me working in social studies, and she was teaching a women's studies course, and I got to do some drama and some English, and I had a real varied experience being in the high school, and I think that gave me a comfort level walking into the short and long practicum that, yeah, you know, I can figure this out. I actually wound up accidentally falling into special ed because I was doing a bunch of short-term contracts, and there was a position opening for an extended skills program was what they called it, and it was working with grade 8 and 9 students. And so with the grade 9s, I taught social studies and English, and then worked with a resource teacher to case manage them. And with the grade 8s, I taught them socials, English, science, math, and then there was a support block. And if I never have to teach math again, I'll be really happy. So right now I'm teaching 2 English blocks in our mini school, and 5 blocks of my job is working with the gifted LD, the twice exceptional kids. And
yeah,
it's kind of expect the unexpected every day and be prepared to roll with it.
That to me is the nice thing about teaching, is that it's never monotonous. It's not the same thing every day.
No.
So are there any moments working with the Gifted Learning Disabled program that really stand out to you?
I think generally you get to know the kids so well over the years, and they're so smart, quirky and funny, and you just have a long series of inside jokes. Like one of the students said today, is there a motto for the GOLD program? And I was like, yeah, it's right up there. Just don't ask. Which came out of a student who was very quiet, very reserved, and there was something going on the other side of the room, and I looked up from what I was doing and said, what's going on over there? And he looked up at me and just very deadpan, just don't ask.
So is there anything that you would really like your colleagues to know about students who are twice exceptional?
It's hard. I mean, having been a teacher with a full English load and you've got 200 kids and you're just trying to get through and teach your content, maybe get to know the kids a little bit. Try to develop the relationship with the kids, try to know a little bit of something about twice exceptional or not, because then if you're seeing behavior that is really out of character, if the quiet kid is in a state where they're calling out, they seem really anxious, they're asking to go to the bathroom, take a look at the behaviors and try to see past the behaviors to try and decide what's going on behind those, right? And that's tough. It's tough when you've got a lot of pressure on you. And I mean, we've gone for so long in our system where we've been really strapped and everybody's trying to do everything and budgets are cut to the bone and we're just trying to get through the day sometimes.
Right.
That I know it's not easy, but can you see the individual child and try and help them?
Well, it sounds like that you're talking about flexibility, relationship, and attentiveness, noticing our kids. As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, this is rather a personal story for me and my family, and to make that point clear, I have asked my son Ben to come and speak with us for a few minutes, and he has kindly agreed. Hey, Ben.
Hey.
So I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions. The first one is, what do you recall about the day and sort of the period of time following that you were assessed as gifted learning disabled?
Well, what I remember most about being assessed as gifted learning disabled was the disabled part. That really shines through in that sentence. You know, kids won't hear the gifted portion of gifted learning disabled. You latch on to the things that affect you the most. And when you're young and you don't know who you are, you don't know how to take that gifted portion and, you know, tie it into yourself. It shouldn't have affected me at all. Graduating high school, taking 10 months off, and then going back to school and college, I've never enjoyed learning more in my life. You know, just thinking about it all throughout high school, I always thought it as, you're disabled, maybe you're not cut out for learning, maybe school, you're just not good at school, you should drop out, you know, you can't do this. And after taking a break and going back to learning, I found that definitely, for sure, I have to focus on the gifted portion. The more I understand, especially in my math class, I've never been good with math, but going back in it with a fresh mind and a lighter mindset, I'm learning so much more and in such a better form.
I'm really glad to hear that. And I wonder, I know that I used the word gifted learning disabled with you because that was the language that was used at the time of your assessment.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're calling this episode is twice exceptional learners. And I wonder if you think that that would have made a difference for you.
Absolutely. It makes all the difference. The twice exceptional learner, it just, no portion of it sounds hurtful. But yeah, the twice exceptional learning portion, it's super important because it gives a child, or even an adult who gets themselves assessed, it gives them a drive to say, yes, I am better.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is worth it. It's really important to have that motivational language in it.
Yeah. Okay. I really appreciate hearing that. And it sounds like that's some of the advice that you might have for young people, sort of thinking about the way you talk to yourself, the way you think about yourself in relation to school. Is there advice that you could perhaps offer to parents and teachers when they're dealing with twice exceptional students?
Absolutely. Find the way your student learns best. It is absolutely a case-by-case basis. And I know it can be very difficult and seem daunting at times to say, oh, it's case-by-case. How am I going to manage, you know, 30 students every year?
Right.
And it sounds like a lot of work. But what you have to do is you have to let the children take it into their own hands. And as much as that probably seems like a bad idea, they're young kids, you know? They'll learn what's best for them, and they'll just work on that throughout their life.
I really appreciate hearing that, Ben, and I think that's really sage advice. And I just want to say that I'm very proud of you, my son, and I really appreciate that you've taken the time to speak to us as well.
Absolutely.
Show me all you do is talk. Can you see me? Can you hear me? Do you know it all?
We each struggle with some things that others find a breeze, and we each make look like child's play some things that others find insurmountably challenging. Part of our work as we engage in schooling is to determine which things are which. And part of the work of teachers is to help us figure that out. While schools and schooling have historically been treated as a one-size-fits-all enterprise, educators, researchers, and administrators are now trying to do better to address the reality that we each learn a little differently and have different interests and aptitudes. And we're learning more about how developing young brains work every day, leading me to hope that there will be increasingly positive experiences for students like Ben in the future. Having said that, I think it's also important to remember that there is life after school and that our brains keep developing into our early 20s. The K-12 experience is not, and never should be, the end of our educational story. Well, that's it for Season 1 of The Situation of Education. We've covered a lot of ground in the last few weeks, and my own biggest takeaway is that, as usual, the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. We're off for a short rest now, before we start to prepare Season 2, and if there's anything you'd like to know about, please feel free to drop us a line. Currently, you can find us on Facebook, but keep an eye out for our upcoming blog. We look forward to hearing your ideas and to developing them for next season. Thanks very much to this week's guests, Dr. Serge Lacroix, Janet McCarran, Jennifer Jack, and Ben. Thanks also to our producer and sound magician, Aaron Green, and to the wonderful folks at CITR for hosting us. See you next season, folks. Class dismissed.